This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, author, journalist, and activist Chris Hedges joins us to speak about his new book, America, The Farewell Tour. We'll spend the next hour speaking with Chris Hedges about this magnificent book, where America's at and where we can go from here.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We're living in terrible times. Novelist Barbara Kingsolver has said that it feels like the end of the world. Last week, Hurricane Michael destroyed much of the Florida panhandle. Before that, hurricanes decimated Puerto Rico, and before that, Houston, and before that, New Orleans. Climate scientists predict it will only get worse and that we are rapidly running out of time to hold down the disaster. Many people have observed that Trump is a symptom, not the disease. The insurgency in the Republican Party has installed a purposeful, strategic, and successful ultra-right into power in all three branches of the federal government and in the legislatures of half the states. The war in Afghanistan has been pursued now for 17 years. Iraq and Libya have been destroyed. The military budget was increased by 10% and is now some $700 billion a year, half of what the government spends altogether. Are we on the verge of a climate catastrophe or a great economic crash or the end of the American empire? We speak with returning guest Chris Hedges, who joins us for the entire show. He has written 11 books, including the recently published America, The Farewell Tour. Although he is a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism, Chris Hedges was pushed out of the New York Times for publicly criticizing the Iraq War. He's become one of the most far-seeing critics of the American elite and their government.
Chris Hedges, congratulations on your new book, and welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, it took you 2 years to write this book. Why do you call it America, The Farewell Tour?
Because America, as we know it, will no longer exist within one or two decades. We are on the cusp of the collapse of the American empire, along with severe economic dislocation that often accompanies the decline of empire. The capitalist class, the corporate capitalist class, has hollowed the country out from the inside, destroyed democratic institutions, orchestrated the largest transference of wealth upwards in American history, and most disastrously launched, which is a characteristic of late empire, a military fiasco in the Middle East, 17 years of endless warfare. I mean, the Taliban controls more territory in Afghanistan today than when we went in 17 years ago. And of course, it's also the tremendous waste of resources at a time when we have to confront the existential threat of climate change.
The book starts off appreciating Karl Marx, who died in 1883. You say he was right in many respects. Can you elaborate, please?
Yes. I mean, I don't understand how anyone can have a basic grasp of how capitalism works unless they slog their way through the first volume of Capital. I'm not a Marxist. I come out of Calvin. I have a very dark view of human nature, and I think Marx was very utopian about the kind of society that could be created. But his analysis of capitalism, of course, aided by Engels' research, is unmatched. And he understood how capitalism works as a machine, especially unfettered and unregulated capitalism. Karl Polanyi wrote The Great Transformation, which is also a study of unregulated capitalism, that it commodifies everything. Human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that it then will exploit until exhaustion or collapse. That's unrestrained capitalism. And he also saw that in that reconfiguration of wealth, essentially transference of wealth upwards into the hands of that, in our case, corporate cabal, creates distortions in the economy that turns capitalism into a force that actually cannibalizes the very institutions that make a capitalist democracy possible. This all Marx foresaw. So we see it with the privatization of education. I open the book in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where the city is facing insolvency. And, of course, they're crippled by the fact that 40% of their pension, the city pension funds, were evaporated in the 2008 financial crash. So they're selling off their city assets. They're selling off the sewer system, the parking authority, the utilities, to corporations, which triple or quadruple the prices to exact more tribute from the population. But what happens when they don't have anything left to sell? And they don't have anything left to sell. You essentially see, and this, of course, is the logic of neoliberalism, every service, whether it's, you know, delivering your water, your electricity, providing public education, 70% of our intelligence services are outsourced to private corporations like Booz Allen Hamilton, where 99% of its budget comes from the federal government. But these, not only do they not make these services more efficient, they destroy the very foundations that makes a civil society possible. And Marx, he got all that.
Chris, you write that the economic despair is the engine of fascism. How do you compare the situation in Germany in the 1930s with the situation currently in the United States?
So all of the great writers on totalitarianism, Fritz Stern, who wrote The Politics of Cultural Despair, Hannah Arendt in The Origins of Totalitarianism, they all targeted despair as the engine for a retreat into magical thinking, which is always part of the process of any totalitarian system. And those con artists and demagogues who arose out of a dysfunctional society to prey on that despair. So I watched that in the former Yugoslavia. In the end of the 1980s, you had the economic collapse of Yugoslavia, including hyperinflation, and you vomited up these figures like Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic and Franjo Tuđman because the self-identified, anemic, but self-identified liberal elite that was ruling Yugoslavia after the death of Tito was unable to respond in a rational or meaningful way to the severe suffering, especially economic suffering, that plagued most Yugoslavs. And so not only were they rejected, but the supposed liberal values that they championed were rejected. We're watching this now with a Democratic Party that mouths the language of traditional liberalism, but has certainly since the Clinton administration assiduously served corporate power. So if you look at Weimar in 1928, the Nazi Party, which, and these Nazis, people like Hitler, were just as buffoonish as Trump. You know, Hitler couldn't even speak proper German, and were ridiculed in the cabarets in Berlin and taunted in the same way they are ridiculed on late-night television. So in the 1928, they're polling in the single digits. Then you have the 1929 crash, which particularly is damaging within Germany because of reparations. And so Ebert and the Social Democrats, who are in power, respond to the international banking system by posing draconian forms of austerity, including abolishing unemployment insurance. So history doesn't rhyme, but it repeats. It doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. I think Mark Twain said that. I can't remember. So we should learn from these economic disasters, because they, especially once you get hyperinflation, the ruling elites just have no credibility left. And I've lived through three hyperinflations: Argentina, Nicaragua, and Yugoslavia. So I've seen it.
You call the evangelical Christian right Christian fascists. You write that you use the word fascist quite intentionally and quite precisely. Why is that?
Well, I should preface that by saying that I come out of a religious household. My father was a Presbyterian minister. My mother was a seminary graduate, a college professor. I graduated from Harvard Divinity School. So I'm steeped in a religious tradition. These are Christian heretics. They are people who have acculturated the worst aspects of American capitalism, imperialism, into the Christian religion. They've sanctified these aspects with Christian iconography and language. Now, one of the interesting, I wrote a book called American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War in America 10 years ago.
I read it.
Yeah. And you're right, I didn't use the word fascist lightly. In fact, when I finished the book, I went to Fritz Stern and spent several hours with him. He had escaped, the great scholar on fascism, had escaped Nazi Germany when he was 18, and then met with Robert Paxton, who wrote The Anatomy of Fascism at Columbia University, who is the great scholar on Vichy, to see if I could be argued out of using that word. Bill Moyers did not want me to put that in the title. But I really believe that they are fascist. And when I was at Harvard Divinity School, my great mentor, James Luther Adams, had been at the University of Heidelberg in 1936 and 1937. He had been in the lecture hall when Martin Heidegger would begin his lectures with the Nazi salute. Mm. And he dropped out. He joined the Confessing Church, led by Niemöller, Bonhoeffer, Schweitzer, Karl Barth. And he took roles of home movie film. He was eventually, after a year, picked up by the Gestapo and expelled from Germany. But he took home movie film, not only of the Confessing Church and what was happening in Germany, but more importantly, the so-called German Christian Church, which on one side of the altar had the Christian cross and the other had the Nazi swastika. And I look at the Christian right as an utter perversion of the gospel itself. I mean, the whole idea that Jesus came to make us rich. You don't need to spend 3 years in seminary as I did to figure out that that is heretical belief. You know, the idea that if we empower, you know, our megachurch pastor and turn him into a millionaire and buy seed cloth and prayers and all the little con gimmicks, Jesus will give us a Cadillac. I mean, this is just, and the failure of the liberal church to call these people out for who they are. You read the book because it kind of explains their ideology, but it's very frightening. It predates Trump's magical thinking, alternative facts. These people have been hermetically sealed, tens of millions of Americans, into a form of collective self-delusion through Christian radio and broadcasting. I mean, we don't see it unless you're in it. And these figures, these megachurch pastors, and I was in towns in Ohio, which were downtown was boarded up and the streets were so potholed you couldn't drive more than 15 miles an hour through the center of town. And the one gleaming building is the megachurch that pulls in $30,000 every Sunday. And so some people have asked, how can the Christian right have an alliance with Trump? And I said, no, you don't understand the Christian right. These mega pastors, almost all white male narcissists who can't be questioned, replicate in every way Trump's grotesque deficiencies, with maybe, at least this is anecdotal, this exception, their sexual proclivities are probably kinkier than Trump's. But they're the same people. And that's why he got 81% of the evangelical vote. And that's why Kavanaugh is on the Supreme Court. The Kavanaugh hearings were just a window into our political dysfunction, the political theater, the outcome was preordained. Susan Collins, agonizing over whether Kavanaugh is going to revoke Roe v. Wade was political theater, because the whole reason the Christian right was shoving Kavanaugh down everyone's throat is because he was going to revoke, is going to revoke Roe v. Wade. And he is also, as Ralph Nader said, a human being masquerading as a corporation. So the Christian right is filling the ideological void. Trump has no ideology, but it's filling that void very rapidly. And Kavanaugh was an example of that. And they are very frightening because they're organized in the way the left is not. Liberty University, the Patrick Henry Law School. And as Chomsky says, we may get rid of Trump, but Pence, who is a creature of the Christian right, will be worse.
What sort of society do they envision? Let's say with respect to women, start with.
It was fascinating being around them. And I was always very upfront about who I was. I mean, I was attending pro-life weekends in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and creationist seminars in Missouri. I took an evangelism explosion course with D. James Kennedy. This was like before people knew how to do Google, which if they'd Googled my name, I would have been in deep trouble. It was fascinating to watch because the society that they envision is one that embraces chauvinism, misogyny, racism, turning the wars in the Middle East into a kind of Christian crusade against satanic believers, which just is the Christian version of Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens, that's why their political views coincided. The one was fundamentalism can come in secular form. They're fundamentalists. They see the world in a binary, black and white, Manichaean view us and them, good and evil. You go back and there's two things that I draw on from my seminary education in regards to this movement. One is when you externalize evil, when you see evil embodied in the other, then you are blind to the evil within. And in the name of combating of a righteous cause, you commit terrible atrocity. That's the first theological precept. And they don't have it. They externalize evil. The other is idolatry. Because the nature of idols, if you study idols, is that they call at the beginning for the sacrifice of the other, but they always in the end require self-sacrifice, that you consume yourself. And the blessing of imperialism, the corporate, the most retrograde forces in American capitalism bankroll the Christian right because of... they peddle this idea of magic Jesus. If you work in a warehouse somewhere, I mean, there are warehouses where they bring in evangelical chaplains because you don't need a labor union, you don't need health insurance if you have magic Jesus. And so there are awash in funds. They have built tremendous political inroads in Washington. We are now watching these ideologues being appointed en masse to federal judgeships. And at a moment of crisis, they are extremely dangerous. They prey on legitimate anger and legitimate despair of, let's say, half the American population. And I interviewed dozens of these people, and my empathy was with them. I mean, I think they're part of a dangerous movement, and they're manipulated by some very dark figures like James Dobson. And I was in the room with James Dobson, and he is as evil as he looks. But the despair is real. The suffering is real. So, you know, I would do these interviews and it was sexual and domestic abuse and struggles with addictions, underemployment, chronic unemployment, all of the attendant problems that come with the destruction of social bonds and the disintegration of community. And finally, they can't take it anymore. And so they retreat into this magical world that is offered to them by the Christian right and is always offered by any totalitarian system, which are not, these are non-reality-based belief systems. So I was in Detroit with Tim LaHaye, who wrote the End Time series, and this was a celebration of the coming apocalypse. And a celebration is the right word. These people were ecstatic, and they had these gory descriptions of what would happen to non-believers, and their blood would start to boil, and their eyes would pop out of their heads. None of this is in the Bible. The rapture is not in the Bible. It was the point I was going to make earlier. What was fascinating is when I would tell them my background, they never wanted to speak about the Bible with me because they don't know the Bible. They're selective literalists. I mean, I read the New Testament in Greek, or at least I could when I was in seminary. Well, they are fed slogans, cliches, parts of passages, you know, bits and pieces that buttress the ideology. But this lust for the apocalypse was fascinating for me because really what it was for is a lust to destroy the reality-based world that almost destroyed them. And at the end of that book, I said the only way to break the back of this movement is to reintegrate these people into the economy. Otherwise, you're finished. You're not going to argue them out of creationism because they will react with the fury of anyone who, or even terror, of those who cannot be pushed back into that world that almost consumed them.
Chris, how much of the population do you think we're talking about in what to me sounds like a rather cult-like movement?
It is cultish. And, you know, Margaret Singer's book, Cults in Our Midst, ended up being an important resource for me in terms of understanding how the Christian right works. Also, Hannah Arendt's understanding of the difference between propaganda and indoctrination. We see the propaganda, I grew up in the Presbyterian Church where the pews, I guess, were designed to be as uncomfortable as possible. Here there are plush seats and a nice band, but that's the propaganda. And then what they do is draw you in for the indoctrination, sever you from your family and friends who have not been saved. I mean, they talk about themselves as caring about the family. They're the great destroyer of family. And I sat in prayer groups where everyone was weeping because their husband, didn't see their husband and he was going to hell and they didn't see their son or whatever. But they take all your time, your educational time, your recreational time, your religious time, And once you get into those systems of indoctrination, you're assigned disciples to make sure you don't backslide. But it has all of the qualities of cults, including when I took the evangelism explosion course with D. James Kennedy, you always went out in teams of three, and it was quite callous. He said we have to target people who have just are in grief over losing a loved one, or are new here to the neighborhood and don't know anyone and are lonely, or people who've just suffered a crisis like unemployment. I mean, it was really, and we are their new best friend. But yes, it has a very cultish aspect to it. It's a very, very dangerous movement. And the Christian liberal church, which I come out of, has utterly failed in the name of tolerance in giving these people religious credibility.
Can you quantify it? How many people do you think belong to these cults?
Tens of millions. We don't know. There are those in the gray zone. But what is it? 40-something percent of Americans believe in creationism? It's some figure like that. It's quite high.
No, it's terrible.
I don't remember how high. But
angels. If you come to them with some kind of program to reintegrate them into a society, what kind of things would you suggest? What would you offer? How can you get to where we are, to where we want to be?
Well,
what do you want to tell them that we should be for?
It's called socialism. I mean, it is to remove the stress and re-knit the communal and social bonds that the corporate state has destroyed, so that you're not put in a situation, as so many families in this country are, where corporations hold your sick children hostage, bankrupt yourselves trying to save your son or daughter. I mean, this is an insane system. The whole gig economy, the temp economy, the lack of job security, the suppression of wages. American productivity has increased since 1973 by 77%. And as the New York Times, of all papers, pointed out a few weeks ago, if wages had kept pace with productivity, the minimum wage would be well over $20 an hour. And yet a third of the American workforce, 41 million people, are attempting to live on less than $12 an hour without employer-sponsored health insurance. So as bad as that is. So you have created such a system of instability, constant stress, where you're a few paychecks away from bankruptcy, and we have to rebuild a society. And if we don't rebuild it, and especially as we barrel towards another economic crisis, then the pathologies that are rippling across the American landscape, and those are the pathologies that I examine in the book, the opioid addiction, gambling, which I write out of the old Trump Taj Mahal before it closes and before Trump announces, suicide, sexual sadism, all of these pathologies that are characteristic of any dying civilization, look at the end of ancient Rome, will explode in very frightening ways. And then, of course, the big problem in America is that we are a deeply violent culture, and we are awash in weapons, including AR-15s, which I used to hunt. I grew up in Maine with all my relatives. I don't hunt now, but I mean, I was taken out as a kid. You know, those weapons are useless as hunting weapons. The caliber of the bullet is too small. You couldn't take down a deer with it, unless, I guess, you riddle the deer with 15. I mean, I think it fires 100 rounds a minute. So, yeah, they're meant for one thing, and that's to kill people.
Chris, you've just alluded to a few factors seen in decaying societies. What would you say are the common denominators generally?
I always read around the books I write. And for this book, one of the important texts for me was Emile Durkheim's book on suicide, published in 1897, Durkheim, the great sociologist. A fascinating period in Western intellectual history, because you had Marx, Weber, and Durkheim all playing off of each other. And Durkheim set out to examine what is it that drives individuals and communities to commit acts of self-annihilation. Freud addressed the same issue in Civilization and Its Discontents. And Durkheim, who, like Du Bois, probably America's greatest intellectual, married brilliant scholarship with rigorous research. I mean, he just went out. He looked at the records. He did interviews, as Du Bois did. And he found that those individuals or communities that had strong social bonds and the ability within those communal systems for self-actualization were the least susceptible to carrying out acts of self-destruction. When those social bonds were broken, when people felt trapped, and there was no possibility of self-actualization, then they retreated into a state that Durkheim calls anomie. And it's interesting that the exact translation of anomie is rulelessness, which means that the rules of the social contract no longer work. In our case, you work hard, you get a good education, you obey the law, you can self-actualize yourself, you can reach your potential, you can reach your goals. And Matt Taibbi wrote a pretty good book on this called Divide, where he looked at the two-tiered legal system. So he covered what happened in the court system for the people who carried out the fraud at Goldman Sachs. But then he went down into poor neighborhoods where, because these corporations have orchestrated, in essence, a tax boycott. I mean, under Eisenhower, the highest tax rates for the wealthiest individuals and corporations was 91%. So, and he looks at how you have all, especially in poor communities like St. Louis County, you have these budget shortfalls, and they make it up by extracting the money from the poor. And they do it with these ridiculous fines. It's like, you know, Garner selling loose cigarettes, or, you know, carrying an open container, or there's actually a fine for obstructing pedestrian traffic, which means you're standing on a sidewalk. So it's rulelessness. There's one set of rules for the oligarchic elite. In essence, no rules. I think a writer for New Yorker said they all live in Richistan. And yes. I think Taibbi said they live in a stateless archipelago. But it's true. I mean, they're immune. And then there's a whole other set of rules for us. So that rulelessness, in essence, creates paralysis within the society for most citizens. And eventually people, out of frustration, out of anger, out of a kind of self-loathing because they believe that they have failed and they are told repeatedly that they have failed, begin to carry out activities which are self-destructive. I write about hate groups. I'm with the Proud Boys and Knights of the Alt-Right and Three Percenters. In fact, at one point in the book, I'm standing in the woods outside of Binghamton, New York, at night around a bonfire with these guys. And that is where I really wished, prayed to God no one would Google me. But, you know, as Durkheim writes, people who yearn for the annihilation of others are driven by desires for self-annihilation. The gambling, I didn't really understand how evil gambling is until I researched it. And there's a good book by a professor at NYU called Addiction by Design, Shul, because she studied how the industry preys on these addicts. 80% of the people who gamble now do it on slots, and they'll sit there for 5 or 6 hours. And, you know, the whole security and surveillance system within casinos is quite advanced. They even have all personal profiles. I mean, Homeland Security actually took some of the pioneering steps that they took. They give you player cards. They don't want you to use cash because they want to track you. So they know when you get frustrated and a hostess will magically appear with a free drink or a voucher for a show or something to keep you there. I mean, people will, like, wet themselves. I mean, it's insane. And gambling addicts have the highest rates of attempted suicide of any addict. So, again, these are all self-destructive pathologies. I have a chapter on heroin where I'm with heroin addicts. But they're a way always for people to try and anesthetize themselves. They call it, with gambling, it's being in the zone. They're looking for escape routes. They're looking for ways to check out of a life that has just become almost unbearable. And so these self-destructive pathologies are interlinked. We don't treat them as being interlinked, but they are driven by this anomie, by this rupture of social bonds, which is why we have to recreate those social bonds and counter that enemy if we have any hope of saving what's left of our open society.
We're speaking with Chris Hedges, whose latest book, America, The Farewell Tour, has just come out. It's a marvelous book. I urge everybody to pick it up and read it. Chris, you write about how empires come to an end and the defeat of the Greeks in Sicily There's one thing you write about, the defeat of England in 1956 and their invasion of Egypt. What about America's wars in Afghanistan and Iraq? What has been their effect on the American empire?
Right. So this is the characteristic of late empire. Alfred McCoy wrote a good book about this called In the Shadows of the American Century. You know, empires at the beginning actually use military force very judiciously and carefully. And then in decline, they tend to engage in these grand military schemes which only accelerate the decline. The Soviet Union going into Afghanistan would have been a good example. What we saw with the British, when the British Empire was on a slow decline since the end of World War I, after they committed, you know, massive suicide in the trenches in Europe, but the denouement was 1956, when they had to retreat from Egypt in humiliation. They went in because Nasser had nationalized the Suez Canal. What really destroyed the British Empire was shortly thereafter when the pound sterling was dropped as the world's reserve currency. And that is what will kill it. The two things that will kill us quickly, one is the impending financial collapse, because what's happened since 2008 is that the Fed has produced, according to the University of Missouri, $26 trillion of fabricated money out of electronic ether, handed it to the financiers and the banking system. They haven't used it the way traditional capitalists use it, investing in manufacturing, creating jobs. They just gamble and speculate. So, for instance, the fracking industry doesn't make any money. The value of the fracking industry is based on projected profit, in the same way the dot-com industry was based on projected profit. It's now swallowed $280 billion. I mean, one day it's going to stop. The way the debt peonage is, because they borrow the money at 0% interest, but they do have to pay it back. Whether they don't, they buy back their own stock. And every time I hear somebody tell me that the economy is great because of an overheated stock market, where stocks now no longer have any correlation to the value of the corporations, I want to hand them John Kenneth Galbraith's book, The Crash. So they've set us up but they don't have a plan B this time around, because they can't lower interest rates any more than they already have. So that will create a recession or a depression that will dwarf what we saw in 2008. I mean, if they try and create another $26 trillion out of electronic ether, it's called hyperinflation. That's the first thing. The second thing is the day the dollar is dropped as the world's reserve currency. We watched Iran is already, that's part of the animus towards Iran, is there are two reasons people like Bolton go after Iran. One is because they've made such a mess of the Middle East, they need a scapegoat. It doesn't even make any sense, because the Iranians' mortal enemies are the Taliban. And secondly, because the Iranians don't use the dollar anymore, just as the Venezuelans have announced they're not going to use the dollar. That is the death blow. At that moment, the day the dollar is dropped as the world's reserve currency, the American empire comes to a screeching halt. And you can go back and look at what happened to the British economy when they dropped the pound sterling to get an idea, because it's a fictitious value, the dollar. Nobody wants to buy U.S. Treasury bonds. Our debt is exploding. We're going to be paying about $370 billion a year on interest next year. And within 10 years, it's $900 billion a year on interest. That's more than the defense budget. So it's just utter mismanagement on the part of the ruling capitalist elites, who are just looting as fast as they can on the way down. And it's not just the suffering that will be caused by the economic mismanagement, but the political mutations, we already have a president who rhetorically incites violence, the political mutations that will arise out of this morass. And that's what I find most frightening.
Let's talk about the other specter that's haunting America, and that's climate change. 2 weeks ago, Hurricane Michael wrecked much of the Florida panhandle. And before that, hurricanes wrecked Puerto Rico, Houston, New Orleans. It seems that climate change is happening a lot faster than the scientists said it would. What do you think the timetable is when that change will be irreversible, and what effect is it going to have on us?
Well, it's already irreversible. I mean, if we stopped all carbon emissions today, we would still deal with catastrophic climate change. And you're right. Every climate change report has the same theme, which is it is happening far faster than we thought. In fact, we were far too optimistic. And you have this latest UN report that is really giving us a decade to respond. Now, the reason climate scientists are so terrified of allowing global warming to go beyond 2 degrees Celsius is because of feedback loops. And they know what feedback loops do because they've studied it on planets like Venus, which used to have water and is now 800 degrees. In essence, you know, once you lose your polar ice caps, once your oceans acidify, your sea levels rise, your temperatures rise, your crop yields decline, your wildfires devastate, as they already are, states like California or Australia, and you unleash monster storms and the jet streams go all wacky and the Gulf Stream disintegrates, then these various forms of ecological distress play off of each other, and there's nothing you can do. So if you talk to climate scientists, they've run mathematical models, and they range anywhere between a 70% die-off to complete extinction. Of course, again, as a country, as a culture, we have not only retreated into two forms of magical thinking. One is climate denial, but the second is that we can adapt. You know, the greatest existential crisis facing the human species is determined by corporations like ExxonMobil or that kneel before the altar of short-term profit at the expense of life itself. And that is why we not only don't have any time, but we have to recognize that the ruling elites, the systems of corporate governance that are in place, are not only reformable, but will kill us. And they have to be overthrown. And we have no time left. And the Democratic Party is part of the charade, part of the political theater, culpable in many ways, especially under the Clintons, for the social inequality that created Trump. Trump is not a creation of Russian bots or Comey or Podesta emails. He is a creation of the worst income inequality in American history. And the rage on the part of a betrayed working class. And that betrayal was carried out by both the Democrats and the Republicans. And of course, he's the symptom. He's not the disease. He's the symptoms of a decayed society. The con artist who arises and promises to make America great again and, you know, all your jobs will come back. I mean, anthropologists call it crisis cults. You know, when you're in deep distress, you will reach out to forms of magic. 1890, Wounded Knee, the ghost dance. You put on the shirts. It stops the white colonizers' bullets. The buffalo herds will come back if you engage in this Sufi-like dance that throws you into hypnotic state. The warriors will rise up from the earth. And the white Euro-Americans and Americans will disappear. And instead, the 7th Cavalry sets up Gatling guns and kills everyone. But we are as susceptible to those kinds of crisis cults and magical thinking. I think the Christian right is a crisis cult. The worse it gets, and we're already seeing it in American society, the more people want to turn away and not look. And it is bleak. Climate change is bleak. The destruction of our failed democracy is bleak. Our economic outlook is bleak. But we're far better off facing reality and responding than pretending reality doesn't exist. Because if we pretend reality doesn't exist, it's really a form of infantilism where we refuse to be adults. And what happens when things break down is you react as infants. You scream for that strong figure who's going to come in and protect you, but what you're really screaming for is your own enslavement.
If the Democratic Party is hopeless, and I agree with you on that, and socialism is the answer, then therefore I imagine that we need our own party. What would a party like that look like? What would it stand for? Who would it represent? What would it do?
I mean, I worked with Ralph Nader, and I saw all of the impediments the Democratic Party threw up to block Nader because Nader was a threat to the Democratic Party.
I supported Nader.
Right. The two parties have really collaborated to lock out any. After Ross Perot got 19%, that was kind of too much. That's why they can't get into the debates. That's why they challenge their voter lists. you know, they lock them out of the mass media, or the mass media, you know, MSNBC/Comcast will ridicule third-party candidates or just not report on them. I mean, MSNBC was really an arm of the Clinton campaign. They were very hostile to Bernie Sanders. So I do support third parties. I've not voted for a Democratic presidential candidate since 2000, or before 2000, because I voted for Ralph. But that's not going to save us. I mean, we need to rebuild militant movements, which unfortunately is a long, slow, and very unglamorous prospect, around tangential issues that cross political divides, raising the minimum wage, creating universal health care for all, defending Social Security, which is the next thing they want. We're going to have to build around those issues, and we're going to have to make alliances with people whose politics are different from ours, even repugnant. And I was in Anderson, Indiana, in this book, where GM used to have many of its factories. Clinton passes NAFTA. By 2006, they're all in Monterrey, Mexico, where they're paying Mexican workers $3 an hour without benefits. So you've thrown 25,000 American workers, union jobs, UAW jobs, making $25, $30 an hour with pension plans, benefits, out of work. They don't just abandon the plants. They actually bulldoze them. So these huge weed-choked lots. I was with UAW workers in Anderson who'd spent 20, 30 years of their lives in those. They won't even – they'll bypass the streets. They can't even look at it. They voted for Sanders in the primary, but they voted for Trump. They weren't going to vote for Clinton. And it just shows you how tone-deaf the Democratic Party is and is right now. They are adopting the same strategy the Clinton campaign adopted, which is Trump is repugnant, Trump will implode. They're not offering anything because they're creations of – there's only one party. It's the corporate party. So on one end, you have the troglodytes and the racists and the nativists, the Mercers, the Sheldon Adelsons. And on the other end, you have the – Princeton-educated, Lloyd Blankfein went to Harvard, you know, these kind of well-heeled speculators and financiers who don't want to be identified as Islamophobes or homophobes or racists, but are as complicit in creating the economic assault that has brought us to where we are. And figures like Pelosi and Schumer, they are creations of Wall Street. I mean, their power comes from funneling that money to the anointed Democratic candidates. And if I hear one more time about all the women who are running, I mean, this is just, we've got to grow up. I mean, what do they stand for? I mean, what percentage of them, it's quite high, are drawn from the military and the intelligence community? I mean, the whole idea that, you know, is Condoleezza Rice the same as Cynthia McKinney? I mean, this is just nuts. So the Democratic Party and the leadership of the Democratic Party, Perez and others, are well aware that if there was serious campaign finance reform, i.e. dark and corporate money was out of politics, they wouldn't hold power. They are creations of that system. And I think they have they must on a certain level understand how fragile it is. And they're running it close on these midterms. And they may lose. I mean, they might squeak by in spite of themselves. But if they were to engage in serious reform and address the social inequality that Sanders, who they stole the nomination from, if they were addressing it, they wouldn't have power. They wouldn't exist. And they have decided that they would rather that everything collapse than give up their kind of first-class accommodations. So the Democratic Party is not reformable. It doesn't even function as a real political party. In fact, in Europe, the Democratic Party would be a far-right party. But the left is, you know, that's the beauty of the public relations industry and a media that serves the interests of the ruling elites. In election cycle after election cycle gets fooled or becomes spineless or something, I don't know. But time's running out. The Democrats are not going to save you. And we've got to organize and embrace a kind of militancy to bring this system down. Or we're finished. We're finished. We're finished as a species.
America, the Farewell Tour, Chris Hedges' new book, lays it out very dramatically and very persuasively, and I urge all of you to get it. Chris, there are a number of passages in your book that I think are outstanding. I chose one that I wanted to ask you to read, but perhaps you have one that's your favorite, and we could read that.
Well, I have a passage I like, but I didn't write it. Irving Howe wrote it. This initially is me writing. When a tiny cabal seizes power, monarchist, communist, fascist, or corporate, it creates a mafia economy and a mafia state. Trump is not an anomaly. He is the grotesque visage of a collapsed democracy. Trump and his coterie of billionaires, generals, half-wits, Christian fascists, criminals, racists, and moral deviants play the role of the Snopes clan in some of William Faulkner's novels. The Snopeses fill the power vacuum of the decayed South and ruthlessly seized control from the degenerated former slaveholding aristocratic elites. Phlegm Snopes and his extended family, which includes a killer, a pedophile, a bigamist, an arsonist, a mentally disabled man who copulates with a cow, and a relative who sells tickets to witness the bestiality, are fictional representations of the scum now elevated to the highest level of the federal government. They embody the moral rot unleashed by unfettered capitalism. The usual reference to amorality, while accurate, is not sufficiently distinctive and by itself does not allow us to place them as they should be placed in a historical moment, the critic Irving Howe wrote of the Snopeses. Perhaps the most important thing to be said is that they are what comes afterwards, the creatures that emerge from the devastation with the slime still upon their lips. Let a world collapse in the South or Russia, and there appear figures of coarse ambition, driving their way up from beneath the social bottom, men to whom moral claims are not so much absurd as incomprehensible, sons of bushwhackers or musics, drifting in from nowhere and taking over through the sheer outrageousness of their monolithic force. They become presidents of local banks and chairmen of party regional committees, and later, a trifle slicked up, they muscle their way into Congress or the Politburo. Scavengers without inhibition. They need not believe in the crumbling official code of their society. They need only learn to mimic its sounds.
Yeah, that was an extraordinarily powerful passage. I'm glad you chose that one out. It stuck in my mind when I read it. Chris, let me ask you about something that's going on right now, which I think is significant. In your book, America, the Farewell Tour, you give the reader a way to understand what's going on politically and morally and economically in America today. It's a real dose of reality, as Ralph Nader wrote. Reading it, I was better able to appreciate the news about the murder of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He was lured into the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul, where he was tortured, murdered, cut into pieces, and smuggled out. Despite this, Trump announced that he would continue the $100 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia because it would save 500,000 American jobs. How do you appreciate
this? Well, first of all, I knew Jamal. He and I worked together in the Middle East. And he was a lovely, decent man. I would point out two very frightening consequences. One, this is another example of the permanent lie, which comes out of the Christian right. Reality doesn't matter. Verifiable fact doesn't matter. I mean, the Turks have provided pretty ample evidence that he was murdered inside the consulate on the orders of the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. But that doesn't matter. It's like the Trump's inauguration crowd. You can put a picture of Obama's crowd next to Trump's inauguration crowd, and he still has the largest crowd in American history. That's the permanent lie. So all politicians lie. Clinton lied when he conned us into NAFTA by telling us that it would create lots of good-paying middle-class jobs. George W. Bush lied when he claimed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. They don't continue to make those claims. The permanent lie, which is a part of any totalitarian society, utterly disregards reality itself, utterly disregards fact. And as Hannah Arendt writes, that permanent lie essentially destroys the ability by which a society can communicate, because communication or national discourse is no longer based on fact. And it also creates a collective schizophrenia, I'm sure we all feel it, where reality is staring you in the face, and yet it's denied, it's denied, it's denied. That's the first thing, because the whatever lie the Saudis decide upon is the lie that Trump will embrace. And is clearly a lie. I mean, it's transparently a lie. The second thing is that these global elites are interconnected. And by, in essence, giving a green light to a despotic regime like Saudi Arabia to kill a journalist. I wouldn't even describe Jamal as a dissident. He was quite close, in my mind, a little too close sometimes, to members of the ruling elite in Saudi Arabia. Although he would defy them, he was very outspoken about the attacks of 9/11, even though he knew Osama bin Laden. He was very public about his condemnation of the beheading of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter. He spoke up for women's rights. I mean, these were all at tremendous costs. But any kind of opposition, any kind of criticism, if this is allowed to essentially take place without any repercussions for Saudi Arabia, which is what I expect, will make it far more dangerous for the rest of us. Because what Trump and the corporate powers are in essence doing is sanctioning political assassination and making it clear to the rest of the world that there won't be any consequences. And that makes the safety for all of us, or puts the safety for all of us, in jeopardy.
What about Trump's justifying his support of the Saudis on the basis of the $100 billion arms deal?
Well, you know, they haven't signed it yet, and they may never sign it. The Saudis are about as credible in terms of promises as Donald Trump himself. He may be in the midst of a con himself. But they certainly haven't come through with that kind of money or those kinds of contracts, and I wouldn't be surprised if it never comes through.
But the weapons that the United States has already sold Saudi Arabia are being used to murder and starve and cause disease of hundreds of thousands of women and children in Yemen. And there's no discussion of that. The amorality of that is just shocking.
Yeah, although, and that's all true, but we can't turn our backs on what we do in Syria and Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, in terms of the cumulative killing, we've far outpaced the Saudis. So our moral authority is gone internationally. The invasion of Iraq in particular was a unilateral decision. There was no attempt even to create international consensus. We've become a rogue state along with Israel. We are in many ways a kind of world pariah. We're the laughingstock of most of the rest of the world because of the Trump White House. The utter mismanagement of every aspect of American society is antithetical to not only good management, but a democratic state. We are governed by kleptocrats. We've been governed by kleptocrats for a long time, but with Trump, it's like there's just no restraint left. I mean, it's just naked personal pillage for him and his properties, but pillage for all of the corporations. I mean, the Wall Street and the defense industry and the fossil fuel industry, they all find Trump an embarrassment, but he's given them what they want. He gave the military what they want. They didn't even ask for 10% budget increase, and they got it, and they're allowed to direct their wars in the Middle East without civilian interference, you know, dropping the mother of all bombs on the massive tunnel complex that the taxpayers built with the CIA, taxpayer money, the CIA built with taxpayer money. I don't know. I mean, it was millions of tens, probably hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, that for me was just the final sort of image of, you know, bombing the tunnels we built. So everything has been upended. Iraq as a unified country is gone. We've created one failed state after another, Syria, Libya, parts of Iraq, Afghanistan. The Taliban controls more territory in Afghanistan than when we went in 17 years ago. None of this is good for anyone, there or here, except the arms manufacturers who are making a killing. which is why they're also expanding NATO up to Russia's border, because it's business. But it doesn't make the world safer. And in fact, it makes our security more precarious.
Chris, you've written a very fine book, America, the Farewell Tour. I urge everybody to get it. How can people follow you in your work, Chris Hedges?
Well, I am on no social media. I don't have a web page, Facebook page. I don't tweet. You can read my columns on Truthdig every Monday. There is a Twitter account, but I'm not on it. I can't read it. I think it's Chris Lynn Hedges or something. But I only have him tweet out articles, or I don't give you my two-sentence thought for the day. So, yeah, I kind of stay off of...
Talk about RT.
Yeah, and I have a show called On Contact, that's right, on RT, which has just been taken off the air in New York State and California and will be shut down, I suspect, because we give a voice to anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist critics.
It's a great program. One last thing before I know you have to run. How has your book been received?
Well, I have a very loyal readership, and which I kind of have built over the years, so it's done extremely well. But I have to really thank those people who have usually read four or five of my other books and will loyally go out and buy the next one.
Well, I'm one of those people. Chris, I understand that you're speaking to hundreds, even times, sometimes thousands of people around the country. Keep up the good work, Chris Hedges, and thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.